Hey everybody, this is Paul Morales, Executive Director of Not Easily Broken Missions, and tonight we're going to be doing something a little bit different. As many of you probably know, my wife and I actually host two podcasts, this one, The Cord, and another one called Hoosband and Weef. This week on Hoosband and Weef, Carly and I had a very frank and personal discussion about not only what has been going on in our country related to the death of George Floyd and all the events that have followed, but what it is like being an interracial couple living in a small town in Indiana. We've decided that the best thing to do, since that podcast is published on Monday and this podcast is published on Tuesday, to go ahead and have that conversation under the auspices of Hoosband and Weef, and then to reproduce that podcast here on The Cord. So if you've heard it on Hoosband and Weef already, you can go ahead and skip this episode and we'll be back next week with something brand new. But if you haven't yet heard it on Hoosband and Weef, you can go ahead and listen to it right now. It'll be starting in just a moment. And after you're done listening to it, we encourage you to go over to Hoosband and Weef on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this podcast, and check out some of our past episodes. We hope you enjoy them. In the meantime, here you go. Enjoy our discussion on the death of George Floyd and the racial injustice in the United States and how that affects our relationship personally. We hope that it is illuminating and constructive. Thank you for listening.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Hoosband and Weef. I am your host, Paul Morales. I am the executive director and co-founder of Not Easily Broken Missions, which publishes this podcast, and your resident Hoosband. And with me is my fellow co-founder, Carly, our Weef in Chief. Say hi, Weef in Chief.
Hi, Weef in Chief.
And tonight, we are doing something a little different. We had promised you Chapter 4 of our ongoing love story, a love story against all odds, against all logic, and something else. It's been a long week, and I never remember all three things that our love is against. It's all odds, all obstacles.
And all logic.
And all logic, mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's been a really long couple of weeks. And so we, tired as we are taking a sort of interlog out of our story. It was going to be Chapter 4, The Chocolate Turnover, which we will bring to you next week. But
because you don't want to miss out on The Chocolate Turnover.
No, it is a story that you need to hear for sure. But this week, we felt it was really, really important for us to take the time to talk about George Floyd and his death and the events surrounding his death, following his death, mm-hmm. The protests, the riots, the sort of general societal and social media response, and specifically sort of where that touches down for us as an interracial couple, me being a Mexican-American individual and you being white.
Mm-hmm.
You are white.
I am white. Yes. Okay.
Just checking.
But yeah, this is the only conversation worth having this week.
Yeah. And so we need to be engaging that.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is a more updated form of our love story.
It's
in the present.
And that's where we started.
Right.
This love story was in the present. But where we got to a place where we were essentially just talking about our days.
Which was not super interesting for everyone.
Yeah, well, because it was in the middle of lockdown.
And nothing was happening.
Today we continued to be inside for the most part. And so we went to telling our story from the beginning, which had always been the goal and the point of this podcast. But we're going to take a break from telling our story from the beginning and move into the present. And you had an idea for how we should format this conversation.
Yes.
So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I thought that given that you are a person of color, and not only a person of color, you're a mixed race person of color, that puts our relationship dynamic and just your interpersonal life into the limelight this week in a weird way. I think you've been feeling your feelings and feeling yourself and feeling your culture more acutely than maybe you do most of the time, just because of the national conversation.
Yeah, and I think that I think it's worth saying, both as a Mexican American, I probably feel some of this more acutely than, say, the average white American. Mm-hmm. But I also don't feel this as acutely as probably any Black American.
Right.
And there's a tension in living in that, in feeling as a person of color so incensed and so enraged by this tragic loss of life, and knowing that what I feel pales in comparison to what so many others feel. It's an interesting perspective from which to kind of enter into this conversation, mm-hmm. but it's the only one I have. So.
Right. And I think it's worth adding to the conversation in whatever constructive way we can. So my thought for this was, for me, the white person who has no experience with racial bias, at
no
least
experience
not
with Rachel bias, the girl from the mall.
No experience with racial bias directed towards me as a derogatory type of situation. To ask you questions and just kind of pick your brain and your heart about how you're experiencing things and how this is all touching down for you.
Okay.
Yeah. You game?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Okay. Cool. Tell the listeners who you are and what your racial background and your ethnic background is.
Sure. So, as I said in the introduction, my name is Paul Morales, and I am Mexican-American. And specifically, my family comes from Spain. So, my father's first-generation American. His father was born in Hermosillo, Mexico. And then his father, my great-grandfather, was born in a small village on the coast of Spain. And unfortunately, my family did not keep quality records. So I don't know exactly where in Spain. I just know a small village on the coast somewhere. It's always been kind of my dream to start at one end of Spain's coast and just walk the coast, and I figure if I hit all the villages on the way, one of them will have been the one my great-grandfather was from.
I would totally do that with you.
Okay,
like our 20th wedding anniversary, let's just go.
I'm down. That's closer than our first wedding anniversary right now. I want you to think about that for just
a
minute.
Yeah, that's scary. Okay, keep telling us about yourself.
So my father is a full-blooded Mexican person. My mother is white. And I never really gave a lot of thought to my racial identity before high school. The closest I came to thinking about it was being aware that I had some friends who were white and some friends who were Hispanic, and that I didn't feel like I quite naturally fit into either mm-hmm. one. My father was 45 when I was born, and he was not... his father had passed away already. His mother, by the time I was born, I think was very near passing. I think she lived for like another year or two after I was born. And she had dementia. So it wasn't like Grandma Morales was heavily steeping us, the kids, in Mexican culture for a long time. He didn't have a lot of cousins or aunts or siblings that he was really close to. So basically all of his Mexican culture was just in him.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that was, he pretty much kept to himself because he wasn't around a lot. My parents were separated 3 times total in their marriage. Early on in my life, my dad drank a lot. He doesn't drink anymore, but he did at the time, and he just wasn't there to teach us about that. And my mom not being Mexican didn't add much to that, but she also didn't bring a strong culture of her own to the household. It's not like we were very distinctly German and we made like baklava or whatever Germans eat on the weekend.
Right.
And so I didn't have a strong cultural identity for a long time until the ninth grade, I think, ninth or tenth grade. And I remember taking a standardized test. And for the first time, I don't know if this was the first time it ever happened, but it was the first time I remember being really aware of it happening. There was a question on the standardized test that asked me to identify my ethnicity. And this was before Hispanic and Latino was separated out as a subset of white, which pisses me off to this day. But at the time, it was white, Hispanic / Latino, Black, Asian, Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, other were kind of the options. Mm-hmm. And I had to, it's a please choose one. So I had to answer this question, what is my ethnicity? And I thought about it for a little while and I thought to myself, okay, my last name is Morales. And that is a distinctly Latino name. So I must be Latino. I guess that's what I'll put. I'm Latino now.
You decided in that moment.
I decided in that moment that I'm a Latino individual. And I didn't speak Spanish. Boys don't have quinceañeras, but I've never been to a quinceañera. Yeah. We didn't celebrate Dia de los Muertos or any other Mexican holidays. Like, that didn't really mean anything to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a choice that I made. But because I made that choice, I found myself over the next several years and into my adulthood doing some research and building and structuring for myself what it meant to be a Latino man. And now I recognize that I'm biracial. Like, I don't deny that as the fact, but I don't think of myself as biracial. I think of myself as Mexican.
Right. That makes sense. And I think it was interesting when you and I got together, you were, you know, several years into this process now, and you presented yourself as a Mexican person. Like, that was how I met you. But what I think is funny for people watching our relationship, and even now, people ask me all the time, Morales, that's an interesting last name. What is it? I'm like, it's Spanish. It's Morales. Like, I know that I can say it. I can pronounce it not as well as you do. But there's not like there's all these tricky hidden letters. But it's a Spanish name. And that doesn't seem...
Yeah, it's not like Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it strikes me as odd that people assume or don't seem to know what it is.
I got to tell this story really quick. Living here in small town Indiana, once early on, I think we were married at the time. We were definitely at least dating. I went to a job interview, and there was a receptionist waiting to receive me, and she said,
"As receptionists do."
Yes, and she said, "Hi, can I help you?" And I said, "Hi, I'm Paul Morales, and I'm here for a job interview." And she said, oh, okay, well, I'll just call back and let them know that you're here. And so she picked up the phone and she dialed an extension. And then I saw her scribble a note as she's waiting for the other person to pick up the phone. And the note that she scribbled was my name, except she did not write Paul Morales. She wrote Palmer Ellis. And I was just like, honey, no. Nope. Do I look like a Palmer to you?
No.
Are you kidding me? No. Not that there's anything wrong with people named Palmer, but but that is not my name.
No, that's not your name.
Distinctly. Not, and I was just, it, woo. Anyway, I had to tell that story.
So people don't know what Morales is, but people notice that you're from California. That's what they remark on. And there's such a definitive SoCal culture that you bring to the table still, even though you've been here for a dozen years. And I think that that is what people tend to notice about you more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean,
and your dad grew up in South Central.
South Central, Los
which
Angeles,
is not yeah. a highly Hispanic area.
Not anymore. It was when he was a kid.
Okay.
In, when he was born in 1943. It was a largely Hispanic area, and then the Hispanic population migrated to East Los Angeles, and the Black population moved into South Central.
Got it. Okay. That's the one teensy bit of LA knowledge I have, is that South Central LA is a largely Black area.
Yeah. But I think it's actually becoming more and more Asian now.
Huh.
But I'm not sure. I haven't been back in a long time, yeah. to South Central specifically. But yeah, I am distinctly Californian. That mm-hmm. is true. I am a liberal Democrat. I am very, very laid back and chill for the, at least relative to
yeah.
the culture that I find here. And I think especially for the Christian conservative mm-hmm. culture here, I practice a brand of Christianity that's significantly more liberal. And the only way that people who live here can seem to wrap their heads around the fact that I am both Christian and a Democrat is that I'm from California. That's like, it's like solving for X. It's like Christian plus Democrat equals X. And it's like, well, the only possible answer is California.
I worked for a lady one time who was also from California or had lived there for a significant amount of time. And what did she say? I was talking about you at one point and she was like, no, I like Paul. I get him. And she said something about Californians having a certain scent about them or a certain taste about them. And she was being metaphorical, but she's yeah. like, it puts a funny taste in people's mouths around here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a distinct flavor and not everybody likes it.
Yeah. and we all like each other. Like,
yeah.
Californians are pretty accepting of other flavors. I yeah. think the degree to which we're accepting is one of the most distasteful things about yeah, us to other people.
Probably true. Okay, so second generation Mexican-American, biracial, from California, that sets up kind of your demographic,
yes.
so people can have an understanding of that. What are you thinking and feeling right now, given our nation's discourse over the last 14 days? What is sitting with you?
This is a hard question for me to answer. I've been thinking a lot about the discourse and the quality of the discourse in our country.
You just always think a lot about the discourse in our country.
Yes, that's true. I was just going to say, in general, I think about that a lot. But in particular, there seems to me to be a willingness of people to listen. Now, obviously, there are some people who will never listen.
Right.
Those people are called racists.
Right.
There are some people who are easily distracted from the messaging. And those are the people who are talking more about riots and looting than anything else.
Right.
The people who are saying, you know, I'm full, Black Lives do matter, and what happened to George Floyd is a travesty, but I can't support the violence.
Right.
I can't support the destruction of property. I can't support the destruction of small businesses and livelihoods, mm-hmm. and all of those things. And to them I say, okay, don't support it, but also don't concentrate on it.
Right.
There is a significant amount of really important messaging that is going on right now. And if you focus on that, you will be distracted from the messaging, mm-hmm. that's out there.
Yeah.
I also think that there is a strong effort to... I'm going to use the word shoehorn.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative of there are good cops out there into this conversation.
Sure.
And I'm not saying there aren't good cops out there.
Because
of course there are. The function, the mission statement of police, at least in the United States, is to protect and serve.
Right.
That is their job. The question is, who are they meant to protect and serve?
Mm-hmm.
Ostensibly, it's whatever community in which they exist.
And have jurisdiction.
Right. The Warsaw Police Department is meant to, where we live, Warsaw, Indiana, is meant to protect and serve the citizens of Warsaw, Indiana.
Right.
The Winona Lake Police Department, which is the town over, is meant to protect and serve the citizens of Winona Lake.
Right.
And so on and so forth through every town and city in the United States. In practice, however, for so many minority people, especially Black people, the police are, although they are meant ostensibly to protect and serve the community, their mission statement is actually, in practice, to protect and serve three groups of people. Themselves, white people, and rich people. And here's... Actually, let me back up a little bit. Today in church, there was a conversation facilitated by our pastor between himself, and he's a white man, mm-hmm. and two Black individuals from the community that he knows, and one white cop that he also knows. And the white cop illuminated something that I think I knew on some level, but I had never actually heard anyone articulate before, which is that there's a parallel between what cops, good cops, want and what the Black community wants. The Black community wants to be treated like individuals, like human individuals who have human value just by virtue of existing,
right.
and are not lumped into a category of criminality or moral evil based on how they look.
Sure.
The color of their skin. Similarly, cops want to be treated as human individuals that have human value based on their existence, mm-hmm. and their character and their conduct, and not lumped into a category of brutality or overuse of lethal force based on how they look.
Sure.
In this case, their uniform.
Right.
Here's where that parallel breaks down for me, though, is the police have guns. The police have tear gas and rubber bullets and riot shields and actual bullets and armored personnel carriers and tanks and helicopters and all kinds of things to protect them from the perception that they might be dangerous. The only thing that Black people have to protect them from the perception that they might be dangerous is the police. And the police are not doing a good enough job of that across the country. It does not matter that there are good cops out there in this conversation.
Right.
In a general sense, it absolutely matters.
Sure.
But in this conversation that we're having right now, it's really not relevant. What is relevant is that there is a disadvantaged group that has a window of space to listen and a population that is newly willing, or a window of space to speak, and,
right,
and a population that is newly willing to listen. And we have to step back as white people, as non-black minority people, mm-hmm, as cops, as lawmakers, as anyone who is in any kind of position to benefit from our lack of blackness or from our positions of power, and listen to what black civilians and citizens are saying about their experiences. That has to be step one. We can talk about the good police that are out there and how they want to be part of change when it's time to talk about that. But it's not time yet.
Because just like we would encourage any couple we were seeing or working with and who is having communication struggles, one of the first things we teach people is, number one, your perception of reality is going to influence your emotional spectrum hugely. And my perception of reality is not going to be changed by you telling me facts.
Right.
Right? Secondly, when it comes to resolving conflict, the first thing you do is listen to each other. Mm-hmm. You have to listen with some empathy. And once that's happened and you've heard the perception, you've heard the story, then we can work on change.
Yep.
So what you're saying is here is that as a country, we need to be willing to say, we're just listening. Mm-hmm. We're not defending anybody else. We're not trying to solve a problem. We're just listening.
Yes.
And what you have to say, we understand is personal to you and doesn't reflect on all of everyone everywhere. But there's enough people in a similar demographic saying the same things that we can't not pay attention.
Right. And we are not done listening until the window of space that currently exists to speak has been opened even wider.
Because we need the conversation to continue and not shut down in 2 weeks when we don't remember who George Floyd is.
Right. The protests that are going around have been met with threats of violence from our president, from some governors and city officials, from chiefs of police and county sheriffs, from individual officers. I mean, you search, you know, hashtag George Floyd, you search hashtag protests, and you will find videos of police shooting at reporters for no reason without provocation.
Mm-hmm.
Shooting at protesters who are being peaceful with no provocation. Dragging protesters from their cars and dragging people who are not even involved in protests,
right,
who are just driving near a protest,
right,
out of their cars and tasing them without cause. I mean, and all of this, while there are good cops out there who are not doing this stuff, all of those things are attempts to close the window of space,
right,
where this voice has the chance to rise. And until that stops, you cannot step in and say, but good cops.
Right.
It distracts from the messaging. And the messaging is so important. Everybody needs to be throwing all of their weight behind getting the message out there. I wish, and I think, that the best cops out there are the ones who are saying, thank you, but I don't need you to defend me. I need you to defend them.
Right.
Like, I'm defending them.
Yeah.
I'm going to use my voice to amplify their voice. I'm not going to ask you to use your voice to defend me.
And the guy on stage this morning, he mentioned how hard it is to be a police officer,
yes,
right now. But then he said, you need to look up, oh, you're going to have to tell me what the names. He said Black Wall Street and Emmett Till. Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. He said, there were several things he said. You
yes.
need to sit and you, and he's like, you, these videos are hard to watch. These stories are hard to read. You need to get all the way through it.
Yep.
Like he mentioned how many times he had
watched
the
right thing to do.
The George Floyd video. And he said, I've watched it 7 or 8 times and it destroys me every time. But until I completely internalize that, I can't be the best police officer I can be.
And if you know a cop who is struggling with everything that's going on right now, I'm not saying don't support them. By all means, you're in relationships with people. Some of those people know cops. Like, somebody knows a cop, and that cop is having a hard time at work right now.
Their son or their brother or their best friend. Right. Or
support those people, for sure. But you can do that in the context of a relationship.
Right.
When you're using your public voice, I think we should be using it to amplify Black voices right now. And I'm saddened at how many people are using their voices to amplify other issues.
And you know what? It's interesting you make that point. And I don't want us to get bogged down here, because this would be a soapbox or a podcast for another day. But we now have every citizen who has access to the internet now has a public voice and a private voice. That wasn't always true.
Yeah.
For a long time, citizens, unless you were a reporter, unless you would, you know, somehow attend a protest or something or get caught on film, you were a lawmaker, you didn't have a public voice. You could share your thoughts with the people next to you, at the barbershop, in the grocery line, over dinner, but that was as far as your voice went. But now, with the advent of social media and the ability for anyone anywhere to publish a blog or a podcast or anything else they want, we all have a public voice. And I think that especially people who maybe didn't grow up in this generation, I think this gets mixed up two ways. I think that people older than us who are still new to the social media era probably don't understand that distinction very much. And you'll often find that those are the people who have Facebook or Instagram or whatever to watch their kids, but they don't actually post on them themselves because they're not used to having a public voice. And then anybody just younger than us who has had social media their entire life, I think they think their private voice and their public voice are one and the same.
Yes.
And these two, both of those things muddy this conversation.
Yes. When you grow up believing that every thought you have is equally valuable to public consumption, you don't filter anything.
Right.
And that's why we have tweets about, like, sweet sandwich, bro.
Right. Or getting in the shower.
Yeah, it's like, no one cares that you're getting in the shower or that you just had lunch. Like, not every single thought you have is something you have to share publicly. Mm-hmm.
But also, your deepest opinion is not necessarily your public voice either.
No,
that's the flip side of that. Like, the big things, the big heart issues are not necessarily what has to be shared at this point.
Either. Yeah, because the truth is that it in a society, you know, a lot of people have been talking about social contract lately. It's this idea that there's an unspoken set of rules that we all agree on, and that's how society works. It's not the laws that make it work, not the written rules. It's the unspoken rules that really make society work. But if we're all talking at the same time about the things that are only important to us as individuals, no one is going to have the chance to agree on anything.
Yeah.
We all either have to talk about the same thing, or some of us are going to have to shut up and let the people who need to talk right now talk, because their issue is the really important one right now. And not every single issue can be important at the same time.
Right.
We can all hold one or two thoughts, three thoughts, four thoughts in our head at the same time, but we don't and shouldn't give voice to all of those thoughts at the same time.
And there's time coming for those other things, for those let's be proponents of change, you know?
Yes.
And let's talk about, and then let's maybe see that how we affect change here could help another disenfranchised group. Like, there's going to be room for that.
Yeah, I keep thinking about, man, if we are able to create racial justice in America in a way that it's never existed before, what might we be able to do for women?
It was interesting today listening to these Black men talk about their experience and thinking, I do that. I do that. Like when they were talking about how they change their diction when they walk into the boardroom.
Code switching.
Yeah, code switching. How they make sure that they're smiling when they walk into a gas station so everybody knows that they're not here to do anything dangerous. And there's so many of those things that I do as a white woman. As a, I mean, I probably, next to the white man, carry almost as much privilege. I suppose we're not like inordinately wealthy, but I'm educated. I have a college degree. I'm pursuing another one. I have a job. We have a house. We're not like renting an apartment. You know, like
if a cop pulls you over, it doesn't occur to you to find the brightest street light possible to park under so that in the event that you're murdered, it can be caught cleanly on camera.
No, for sure. Probably going to poke myself in the eye so that if I cry, I get off. I'm not going to do that. I would tell the truth. But like that would be more my thought because I probably could get away with it if I had a good sob story. So I realize I carry a lot of privilege, but I'm female. And I know this conversation is not about me, but I don't go to the grocery store after dark. I love it in the summer that I can go to the grocery store at 8 and still get home before it's dark, you know?
Yeah.
I do check my diction and my phraseology and everything if I'm in a business setting with men because I want them to take me seriously and not assume I'm being overly emotional. So I never lead with my heart. I never lead with my feelings unless I know the man very well. And then I feel like I can, you know, you put on lipstick and mascara before you go into the mechanic, you get a better deal. Like, it's just, I can remember in college going, my friend and I were running errands. And she's like, you can come in with me, but you got to put lipstick on first. Like, it was, and she was right. You get a better deal that way. Right. You know, like, there's just all these things we have to check. So.
But you know that right now is not the time to go on Facebook and say, yeah, but what about women's rights?
No. No.
And that's, you know, that's, I want us as a culture to universally agree right now is the time to talk about black issues and to listen to black voices. And we'll have time for the other stuff later, but we have to do this first. We cannot have reconciliation between black communities and the institutions and systems. Not talking about individual cops. I'm not talking about Derek Chauvin. I'm talking about the system that creates Derek Chauvin.
Right.
We cannot have reconciliation between black communities and the systems and institutions that have abused and brutalized them until we have adjudicated that brutalization as a society and we have given reparation to the communities that have been brutalized.
We're creating a new social contract.
Right. And then we can have the good cops come forward and say, look at these guys. Mm-hmm. These guys want to be part of the change. Let's bring them into the conversation.
Absolutely.
I don't want to harp too much on cops. I feel like we're harping on cops a lot.
And I was just asking how you were feeling. But this is what...
But this is where I am right now. Yeah. As a person of color, I keep seeing people who are muddying the waters of this conversation. And it's going to do one of two things. It's going to drag it out. Or it's going to snuff it out. And I refuse to let my black brothers and sisters have this conversation snuffed out again. I could list dozens of names that in the last 50 years have started this conversation nationwide. And it always gets snuffed out.
Yeah.
And I think we're all just done. It's not that, like, George Floyd is the perfect martyr that we've all been waiting for. He was a man just like the rest of us. Mm-hmm. It's not about George Floyd specifically.
Right.
It's about asking the question, how many more George Floyds do there have to be before we don't have to have any more?
Right.
And I think we've, enough of us, and black people and allies to black people, are saying, this is the last one. This is the last one that we're going to tolerate before change happens.
And I keep thinking about, so our girls are a quarter Mexican. And in the summer, you see it more. It's been, what, summer for like 2 weeks now?
Yeah.
Like, we haven't actually even really hit the summer solstice. We've been swimming for the last 2 weeks. And their tan lines already surpass all of what I will have all summer. It's like not even fair.
Yeah, they get dark in the summer.
And it's just, yeah, my little Frappuccino babies. But I keep thinking, I don't yet know how they're going to identify. They're three quarters white and one quarter Mexican. And they may say I'm Latina, period. And that's fine. And they may say I'm biracial, period. That's fine. They may say I'm mostly white, but I know I've got some heritage from other countries there. And that's fine. Like, however they want to identify. But I don't know that yet. I don't get to decide that yet. And I have to be ready for them deciding they're a person of color. Because they are. I mean, they have that about them. And I want to be educated and ready to engage that conversation, because I don't want them to ever see, oh, his skin is darker than mine and he got killed. What could happen to me? Like, do I need to not go out in the sun? If my skin is lighter, is that better for me? Is it safer? You know, my name is, all of our kids have very Spanish names on purpose because we wanted to highlight that piece of their heritage. And I don't want them to feel like they have to change their name on job applications, you know?
Yeah.
Our youngest daughter's middle name is Elena. It's E-L-E-N-A. And I still feel terrible about this. When I started teaching preschool, there was a little girl in our class who was of mixed race descent, but mom was Hispanic and her name was Elena. And I was told by the registrar that her name was Elena. And so...
Is that like just people think that our other daughter's name is Risa?
Sometimes. Yeah. And I did that because she didn't look Hispanic. And so I went with that for a while until I loaded her into the car one time, saw mom and went, huh. And then all of a sudden... All of a sudden, I thought, my kid's Hispanic. That's not how I say her middle name. And I asked mom, and she pronounced it for me, and it was Elena. And I was like, huh, okay. And this sweet little girl had never said a thing. She just let us call her by the wrong name for forever.
Absolutely wouldn't, because something that's interesting about the Hispanic population is that we are taught, and I wasn't taught this by my father, but I was taught this by researching Hispanic populations. We as a culture are taught, look at black people. Look at how often they are harassed by police. You don't want that. You don't want some white teacher calling the police on you. You need to be as quiet as a mouse. Do not say anything. Draw no attention to yourself so that there's never a chance that you have to interact with police. Because look what they do to the blacks.
You're real bad at that.
I know.
Just now in this moment, going to say you're real bad about that. But yeah,
because I insist on using my voice.
Yeah.
For causes that I find consistent with justice.
Right.
But as a culture, especially I think probably, you know, I was doing this research in the 90s, and I think this was probably a motif that was common in parenting in the 70s and 80s in Hispanic communities. I don't know if a lot of Hispanic communities are still doing this.
Yeah.
But in that time in American history, we don't want to have to deal with that. You know, we want to, and especially because a lot of us are illegals, like hashtag not all Mexicans.
Right.
But there's, especially where I was from in California, there was a significant portion of the population that were illegal immigrants.
And I remember driving through one time and seeing all the guys outside Lowe's.
Yeah, just waiting for work.
Yeah. I'd never seen that before.
Yeah, And a lot of those guys, most of them, if not all of them, were probably illegal immigrants and couldn't get work because they didn't have any documentation. And, you know, you don't want to get into a situation where you might have to interact with police, because even if they don't kill you, they might deport you back to wherever, you know, Mexico or Ecuador or, you know, Panama or wherever you're from, and you don't want to go back.
Right.
So the only thing to do is to not piss off any authority figure. And so it makes total sense to me that this little Latina girl never corrected you on the pronunciation of your name.
I just felt so dumb because my kid has that name. And I just took what I was told ran with it.
How many white people do we know? How many white women do we know with a different pronunciation of the name Alisa? Or or, you know.
Yeah.
There's like 19 different ways to pronounce that name and to spell it. Like, and, you know, parents get creative with names spellings and pronunciations. What is it? Elon Musk's...
Oh, good heavens. That's not even a name.
X-A12?
No.
Elon Musk, come on our show and explain to us. What the heck, man? What?
Well, given my watching this from the outside and trying to be educated and ready to have these conversations, can I talk about you a little bit?
Yes.
Okay.
I will always accept people talking about me.
Well, I don't know if you're going to love these stories.
Oh. Well, if anyone who's listening to this has listened to Who Spanned and Weave before, I mean, none of the stories we've told about me have been good.
Well, no. They're not those types of stories.
Oh, okay.
So I thought it was interesting. On Friday, you went and got a haircut. And you deliberately went to a barbershop where you knew the guy. You had an appointment with him. And he's also Mexican-American. He's Hispanic.
Yeah, I'm not sure where Maceo is from, but
he's Hispanic.
He's definitely Latino.
Okay. And you texted me. I was at my sister's house. And you said, you're not even ready for this. And I looked at the text message and told my sister, I really hope he's talking about his haircut, because otherwise I don't know what I'm getting myself into. And you said, I've never looked so cholo before. And for white people who don't know, cholo is like Mexican gangster.
Yeah.
Okay. I use that word sometimes and people are like, huh? I'm like, okay. So.
Cholos are... And again, this may have evolved since the last time I did research into what cholos are. But when I was in the 90s coming up, cholos were those guys, they had shaved heads and wife beaters or oversized white t-shirts and those huge blue or khaki shorts that were like as long as pants, but they were actually shorts.
Oh, like you dressed when I met you.
Yes. And white calf socks and white sneakers and gold chains and like chest tattoos. And like when you think of like Mexican thug.
Yeah.
Like, you know, from the hood. Like that's what a cholo is.
Okay. So you taught me this word and I occasionally call you a cholo because it fits. And so you sent me a picture and yes. The way your hair was done mimicked that style. Mm-hmm. And it was really sexy. And it looked really good.
Thank you.
Welcome. You did not have your giant earrings or a necklace on at the time. Yeah, that definitely would have added to the flavor. But you were rocking that. And I think I could just tell that you liked the way you felt. And you even said that you really enjoyed your friend cutting your hair. Because it was just English and Spanish intermersed and in the conversation. And it just felt...
Yeah, natural. It was a very natural environment. Yeah. And we talked, he and I talked a lot about being Mexican Americans in this small, predominantly white town and how meaningful it is to have opportunities to be in a context where you're surrounded by other Mexican Americans and you don't have to code switch and you're just interchanging languages. Like, you'll find a lot of Mexican Americans, especially young Mexican Americans, don't exclusively speak Spanish. They move in and out of Spanish and in and out of English, like mid-sentence. There's just a flow of Spanish to English, Spanish to English, Spanish to English. And
you do that some.
Yeah.
And you do that when you're upset a lot.
I do that when I'm yelling at our kids.
That's how you know if we're in trouble. Like, it's the... Like,
mija, ven aquí, right now. Yeah, so like so it was nice to just be in that context, yeah, where I could be my fully Mexican self and I did not have to be concerned at all about feeling out of place.
So we talk about that, and then you have a photo shoot that night. So I go from my sister's to my mom's, and I'm hanging out there.
I'm a photographer on the side, for yes, anyone who doesn't know that, just for clarification.
And he's really good.
Not a model.
that's true. So you had gone to the Wawasee Marina to take photos, and you texted me right about the time I knew you'd be heading home, and you were like, a cop just tailed me for the last
half hour. For a half hour, a cop was riding my bumper from the marina back to Warsaw, where we yeah, live.
And you said, I'm shaking. And I was like, oh my goodness. Because I never noticed police cars ever until I started driving with you. Because when you first came to Warsaw, if a cop was behind you, you pulled over and let them pass and then got back on the road. We don't have to do that anymore, but you are still super aware. Even when they're in unmarked cars, you'll point it out. So I knew how big a deal this was to you. And I was at my mom's and I read the message out loud. And my aunt, who works for the city government and knows where different populations of people are and kind of the culture of the area, said, if he's coming from the Wawasee Marina, they don't know who he is. Somebody called security. They were running his plates to see if he had any priors. That's why they were on your tail for that long. Like, and to her, it was just a... This is...
Oh, man, isn't that annoying how rich people do that sometimes?
Exactly. And she was just... She's like, I have to go out there sometimes for, you know, for her work. And she's like, I drive around that area. I avoid going through there because they're all so snooty and rich and, you know, whatever. And I'm sorry if anybody lives out there who's listening to this, but y'all have a reputation, I guess, for being very protective of your space. And you've paid a lot of money to be there. She said it's $100,000 in taxes per square foot of lakefront property.
Wow.
Like, I can't even imagine. So she was just explaining kind of the socioeconomic dynamic of that. And she's like, it wasn't because he's a brown man. It was just because they didn't know who he was.
Which I didn't know.
Well, sure, you didn't have any, because you got invited out there to take pictures by somebody who was paying you to be right there.
So I'm driving back, and you know what's weird to me is how many different, like, city lines you cross coming down the road. I was like, you know, cops have to drive, and I don't like that this cop is behind me, but, you know, I'll cross into the next city, and then he'll turn around or whatever. Yeah. And then we crossed into the city line and he didn't turn around. And so I started watching him more closely and I saw him talking into his radio on his shoulder. And I thought, okay, he's talking to someone. There's nobody between him and me. There's not even much air between him right, and me. So he's probably talking about me. So now I'm thinking, How many places where there are likely to be lots of other people are there between where I am right now and where I'm going? Where if I get pulled over, I can stop there and I'll have witnesses
right
to whatever happens.
And unfortunately, where you were driving from, the answer is not a lot.
Yeah. And so I started thinking, okay, if I want to pick up my phone and call Carly and let her know what's going on, because I might not come home tonight. This, who knows what could happen. Mm-hmm. If I take issue with being pulled over for no reason, if I use my voice to stand against injustice, am I going to get shot tonight? Am I not going to see my kids tonight? Do I get to say goodbye to them? If I pick up my phone, is he going to pull me over for picking up my phone? Mm-hmm. Like, all of this is going through my mind. What is the least amount of risk in this situation? If I just pull over, is he going to find that suspicious because I saw him and I was trying right to get away from him, and then he's going to be even more aggressive with me? I was sweating and shaking by the time we got back to Warsaw.
And you don't get scared.
No, not by much.
Yeah.
But that was a bad day.
It was a bad day. And I hated for you. I don't think maybe you felt this as much, but just watching you on the outside, I hated that you had had this moment of like, this is who I am. These are my people. It's good to be here. And then later that day, I can't be this person anymore. Like, I can't be this person and get home safely. You know, it just, it broke my heart that you'd had this moment of like enjoying all of who you are, your culture and your heritage. And then also maybe not feeling ashamed for it, but feeling like it was detrimental to your safety.
Yeah. Yeah. Being brown in this community for 25 minutes felt like a genuine danger to my life. And that sucked.
Yeah.
That was an awful, awful feeling.
And I don't think that happens to you routinely.
No, I feel uncomfortable pretty routinely because I'm brown, but not in danger.
Right. And it's more a perception of I don't fit in here. This isn't comfortable. This isn't natural. Right. Maybe I'm too loud. Maybe I'm too much. But it isn't that sense of I'm not going to make it home. That doesn't happen to you regularly. But when the conversation shifts from let's listen to the people who deserve our attention right now to all the other details of what's going on, it heightens emotion, it heightens illogical discourse, it heightens the fear factor to the point that how else could you feel this week given that situation? You know, a month ago, you might not have quite felt the same way.
That's true.
You would have been uncomfortable. You wouldn't have liked it. But I don't know that you would have thought, I'm not going to see my kids again. I've never heard you say that before in reference to it. I've heard you say that a cop tailed you or something like that. But it's always just been like, you know, like how frustrating. Yeah. But I've never heard you speak about it in terms of fear before. And I just think that when we get away from the main point, it draws out the worst in us because it starts to divide us, not along like political party lines, but along who we're going to side with. And when we have to pick who we're going to side with, tension gets high. And when tension gets high, we're quick to take dignity away from people to prove a point. And I think that just makes it a more dangerous world for anyone of color, for any police officer. Like, it just makes us the worst version of ourselves.
Yeah.
So I promised when I wrote a blog post this week, which we're going to link this podcast to, I promised some resources about white people who are trying to educate themselves and become more immersed in this conversation, things they can do. So I have some things that I have found helpful that I'll mention here in a minute, but I just want to know if there's anything you would recommend.
There is one thing, and it's not earth shattering, but I think it's crucial. There is a gentleman whose name is Baratunde Thurston.
That is a fantastic name.
Baratunde Rafiq Thurston. And he has a TED Talk about how he deconstructed the American narrative of racism one news headline at a time. And how we can affect change, real change, in this country by reconstructing that narrative in a new, more constructive way.
It was really interesting.
And we will link that TED Talk in the show notes. Mm-hmm. But I recommend to anyone, whether you are black or a non-black person of color, or you are a white ally, or you stand against the Black Lives Matter movement for whatever reason. If that's you and you're listening to this podcast, dude, like, come on. Just don't do that.
Mary Beth wondered if when you said you're not even ready for this, if you had tattooed hashtag BLM. Not tattooed, but like shaved it into the back of your crew cut. I was like, yeah, Paul probably did that this week.
You know, there's a local tattoo shop that is doing hashtag I can't breathe tattoos for free in honor of George Floyd. And if this new tattoo that I just got is healed on Wednesday morning, I'm going to message them and ask them if they're still doing that so I can get one.
Of course you are.
If I hadn't already had this one on the books, I would have already gotten a hashtag I can't breathe tattoo. But yeah, we will link this in the show notes. I think it's a crucial, helpful, succinct, insightful.
It's so, and he does it almost spoken word style. Like his cadence is super easy to listen to and just artful. Yeah, it's just really good. Okay. So a couple of things that I have found useful as a white lady trying to figure this stuff out. There's a podcast called Shalom Y'all. I'm sorry. Hold on. Yes, Shalom Y'all. It was Shalom Sisters. It changed. And it's by Oshina Moore. And she is a black lady who works kind of in this sphere. Like, she's a believer, but she works in like the racial rights and equality movement. And she wanted to reach out to white allies and continue the conversation. So her podcast is really interesting about just what's going on and what we can do to be helpful. So that's a good one. Jen Hatmaker has a podcast called For the Love. And whether you agree with all of Jen's politics or theological stances, you've got to agree that she does a great job of drawing people's stories out. And she loves an underdog. So anytime there's been somebody who, a people group that's been oppressed or disadvantaged or disenfranchised in some way, she wants to talk to people and hear their stories. And so she interviews amazing men and women of color, of different nationalities and backgrounds, all kinds of things. And you can pretty easily see from her podcast titles who she's talking to and what they're talking about. So there are a variety of episodes in her. I know she's got like 100 episodes at this point because it's been many, many seasons, but there's good ones to listen to there. And then lastly, there's a book that I read from almost daily called Common Prayer, A Liturgy for Ordinary Radicals. And it kind of takes the idea of the Book of Common Prayer from the Catholic or Anglican tradition, and it's updated it. But one of the main things that, like, if you read in the introduction, they're trying to achieve is seeing the unity between believers in all spheres. And so there's so many good books out right now that are being referenced as far as, like, hearing people's stories, reading about specific acts of racism and injustice. And I think those are good. But if, I mean, they're excellent resources. But if you want something that's just going to kind of seep into your skin and start to change the way you think about the world, this prayer book is helpful. They're short readings for every morning and every evening, and they quote and make a point to quote people who have been oppressed across centuries and across different nations. And it's helpful to think outside of my little cocoon of white privilege. To read this and then to associate the words of the psalmist crying out for help with this quote from this little bit of a history lesson I got about this person, you know? And so it's subtle and it's short, so it's easy to read every morning. It fits nicely into my daily devotions. I kind of like the liturgy of it, but I feel like it's opening my eyes to just the fact that life is so hard for so many people, and I can begin my day by praying for them. And just being aware of what's going on. So like I said, that's a more subtle resource. It's not directly talking about this issue, but I feel like it's reshaping my worldview in a way that makes me a more educated individual.
Well, good.
So we can link those things in the show notes too.
Yeah. Did you have any more questions for me before we wrap up this discussion?
I do not have any more questions for you now.
Okay. We might have to return to this discussion in the future, depending on what develops.
Oh, for sure.
But for now, that's tonight, in this moment, just kind of where we stand with everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt like it was important for us to digest that publicly.
Yeah. I think we don't often get seen as an interracial couple. I've had people tell me, oh, you're just the Moraleses. Like, it's just Paul and Carly.
Yeah.
And like, and I appreciate that my friends just see us as people. That's great. But sometimes I wish they saw a little more than that, because I feel like they miss some of who we are noticing all of it.
I've heard a lot of white people in the last couple of weeks say that they don't see color, and that seeing color divides us, and it's part of the problem. And we shouldn't say Black Lives Matter, because all lives matter, and saying Black Lives Matter just continues to separate out this group of people that should be included in everything. And
but they were born black.
What the problem with that is, just because you don't see color doesn't mean that color is not seen.
Right.
And color is seen not just by individuals other than you who mm-hmm. doesn't see it, but color is specifically and constantly seen and vilified by the system.
Well, and I would rather see color and appreciate it. Because you know what? I wouldn't want to be seen as not female. It would be safer and easier in some contexts for us to all just be one gender. But I enjoy being a woman. And I want to express myself as
a woman. I enjoy you being a woman, too, for
that,
whatever
that works out well for us. I enjoy expressing myself as a woman and presenting myself as a woman. And if you were to say, I don't see gender, I would feel less than somehow. I would feel like you're not seeing all of me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important that we see color and we see ethnicity, and we get to know what that means to that person and celebrate what that means to that person. So I don't know that we always get seen as a mixed race couple. We're not a black and white couple, or, you know, like there's other couples who obviously, because of their ethnicities and heritages, experience this in a more potent way than we do. For sure. Like, there's just no denying that. But I think that at this point, anyone who identifies as a person of color, their voice needs to be heard. And we just wanted to share some of that.
Yeah. So we hope this was an interesting, helpful, constructive conversation for you to listen to. If you have any feedback, you can find us on any of our social platforms. We have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, even Pinterest, all at that website /NEB Missions. You can reach us by email at info@nebmissions.com.
.org.
.org. I always say
.com. You always say .com.
I always say .com. It's .org. info@nebmissions.org. You can even leave us a voice message on this podcast. If you go to anchor.fm/whospandandweef, which we will link down in the show notes. If you click on that, you can leave us a voice message, and you might get a chance to hear your voice on the podcast in a future episode. And if you have something constructive to say, we would love to feature you. So please feel free to leave us a voice message. But thank you for listening, and we hope that this was meaningful to you. Thank you, Carly, for being an ally to the cause of racial justice. As a person of color, I appreciate that, and I know that there are lots of others that do as well. Next week, we will hopefully be getting back to our main love story, our individual love story, with chapter 4, The Chocolate Turnover, and it's a good chapter, so make sure you guys tune in. This has been Whospand and Weef. I'm Whospand.
And I'm Weef.
And we'll see you guys next week. Bye.